This is Weinberg on the Law on CBS Radio, WXYT Detroit, AM 1270.
Good morning, America. Beautiful Michigan. Man, it is gorgeous out there today. Absolutely beautiful. This is Scott Weinberg, and we are here to protect you on all your rights and inform you exactly what is going on in this great land of ours, how we're going to be protecting our right not just to be free from government intrusion, be free in our homes and our cars and our bodies from unlawful searches, but also we are going to follow what's going on affecting those laws and rights in this great state of Michigan. And today we really have a packed show, so we want to be able to start getting to it. We're going to follow what was going on with the Kwame saga, that final display of despair in the courtroom this week. We all know what was going on with Kwame getting sentenced. We'll go right into the courtroom on that later, and then we're going to go and we're going to hopefully have a conversation, if we can get him on the line this morning, with our U.S. Congressman Peter Hoekstra, who's obviously running for Republican nomination for governor. So if we can get him on the line, we're going to talk to him about everything happening with this state and how he potentially can help us, but at some of the problems, and we'll ask him some hard questions about what was going on with Washington and what was going on with his votes in the Intelligence Committee. We're going to talk about also assaults today. We're going to have an opportunity to talk with Assistant Prosecutor Laura Weingarten, who's head of one of the sexual assault units and child abuse units in Wayne County for Kim Worthy, and hopefully get some answers to how we can protect our kids and really understand the laws about what's going on in this state of Michigan and how it affects us, not just us, but our teenagers that too. They're just going to have some good information on that. And if we're going to get to the legal news, but also get to the Second Amendment, because we really have to start talking about that. Did you know that there are over 100,000 applications for CCWs in this state and over a million in this country? And why is that such an increase? What is going on? Is President Obama trying to take our rights away? Is he trying to actually forestall our ability to protect ourselves, not from just the government, which of course was the original reason, but to be able to protect ourselves from our own neighbors, going to the store, driving down through any inner city, whether it's Detroit or anywhere else, and making sure that our loved ones are protected. We're going to go to our second show on that at the end of the hour. But let's go back to Kwame, because that was just a major finale to just a debacle that I'd say everybody in the state is happy it's over with. They are just not going to let this guy out. Let's go right into the courtroom and see exactly what happened with Kwame's sentencing this week.
There's only one statement in that pre-sentence report, statement made by the defendant, with which the people agree. The defendant asked the court to allow him to move on. And the people believe that that's very appropriate. The people believe that it's very appropriate for him to move on from probation straight to the Department of Corrections.
You know, that is fairly typical. Whenever you have a prosecutor who wants to be able to end a situation, do not let this guy stay on probation for whatever reason. Committed another crime. He or she did not, or violated the terms of probation because they didn't do counseling or whatever it is. And especially here, just the blatant failure to pay back your restitution, but also to flaunt other issues that the prosecutor felt important, which is disclose properly their assets, what was going on in Texas, because they let him move back to Texas. And that is really fairly typical for a prosecutor to say, okay, stop it, judge. Just stop this bull and put this guy away. You want to stop this? Don't let him sit in jail. Don't let him stay on probation. Just throw away and lock away the key. And so they were asking for 2 years in prison. But I can tell you, Kwame was not just going easily. He wanted to give his two cents. He wanted to basically beg this court for forgiveness.
I cheated on my wife, Your Honor. I met my wife when I was 19 years old, and I knew she was going to be my wife. We planned to have a family, and on the day I was elected mayor, it was that whole thing, focus and everything changed. Over and over again in this city, every time I come, I'm the guy in the text messages. And this put a pause on everything. That's not me anymore. And as long as I'm back here, thrown in jail, I never thought in a million years, John, I'd ever go to jail in my life. I don't think that anybody has a chance to move forward. So I respectfully and humbly ask for everything that's in me to be free, to continue to be on probation, to continue to work towards the restitution, to not have my children be fatherless, to not have my wife be without her husband, who she's forgiven, and to continue to try to rebuild my life. If there are any rules additionally that I'm supposed to follow, I know now more than ever. Your Honor said one day in one of the hearings that I should have asked the lawyer. I had no lawyer to ask. Funny thing that when you don't have any more money, it's hard to find somebody to do that. Mr. Schwartz, he's been a godsend. Because he stuck with it even though he knows I don't have the money. So, I want to go home, y'all. Where I belong.
Well, unfortunately, he is not going home. He's going and went right to prison. You know, one of the things that we talk about here is what are people's rights before they're convicted? But here, of course, he pled. But once you get sentenced and you get put on probation, people don't realize how much authority the judge has to violate you really on any little ground he wants, whether it's failure to pay costs, anything like that. And here, Judge Groner, for months, put up with simply a flagrant violation of his rules. And I don't know if specifically he was waiting for a culmination of a hearing and then finding it so that he can protect the record on appeal. But there were more violations on probation and reasons to go to prison for Kwame than I think his original conviction was. You know, his conviction was not, as Kwame would say, because he cheated on his wife. That's not why he was convicted. He was convicted because he was lying under oath and he obstructed justice and then assaulted an officer. Now, whether you think that is really serious stuff, he chose to plead, lost his license to practice law, convicted of a felony, went months to jail, and agreed to $1 million in restitution. Okay, maybe that was a bad decision on his part. Maybe he should have gone to trial. But once you do that and you make that choice, you got to live with your choice. And what he did was he put himself under the thumb of a judge who now is going to watch his every move. And that's when he started screwing up. That's when he started coming back and doing all the things that were basically nefarious and hiding assets and all the different things that he was doing, and that including lying to the court in affidavits. And that's where the judge lost it and sent him to prison.
Most substantial, most compelling is that you lie to this court. Continue to lie after pleading guilty to lying in court. Obviously, there has been no rehabilitation. You have not changed, so continuing on probation is not an option. As you have violated probation, you lied in the affidavit, your documents were not fully disclosed, you lied in this courtroom. This court is satisfied that incarceration must now correlate to reflect the above substantial, compelling reasons to deviate. Therefore, you will serve a maximum of 5 years in the Michigan Department of Corrections. Further, you will receive credit for the restitution you have paid and the balance of your restitution. $860,000 shall be paid as a condition of parole. What that means is that your obligation to pay taxes, what that means is that your obligation to pay back the city does not go away with this incarceration. Sergeant, could you secure the defendant, please, and take him in the back? Put your hands behind the back, sir. This concludes that matter.
Your Honor, the pre-sentence reports should be turned into your court.
All right. Well, wait. Before we conclude the matter, if I may, Mr. Schwartz, did you want to say something?
Yes, I'd like to ask for a stay of execution of your order pending appeal.
All right. Ms. Seringa, wait one second. Mr. Kopach, please, 1 second. You can remain for the moment. There's been a motion from your lawyer. I'm going to respond. Ms. Seringas, what is your response?
The people object, Your Honor.
All right.
The court's order should be immediately.
All right. The court is going to deny your motion to stay the matter, Mr. Schwartz. I will. If you want to submit an order, I can sign it right now, or we can give you an order from the court. I can sign it so that you can take it to the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Which would you prefer?
I don't have an order here with me.
All right. I will have my clerk write out an order. I will sign it forthwith. I will give it to you. You can go to the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Your
Honor. All right. Thank you.
Well, Court of Appeals isn't going to care about this. I can tell you right now. Let me tell you how this judge really got Kwame and how it's going to be a long-lasting thing. Whenever you are violated on probation, you now are not. He's not going to jail. He's not going to jail. He's going to prison. Now, he might serve even less time in prison because he got 18 months, which is obviously a year and a half credit for the time that he's done, which was a couple months. And then that's up to 5 years. Now, he's not going to serve 5 years. You can't serve more than 2/3 of the maximum time. So even if he's in prison and he violates the rules of prison, which let me tell you something, is a clear possibility with this guy. Even if he violates those, the most he can do in violations of parole is 3.5 years. Now, obviously a tremendous amount of time for a guy that's never been there. This guy's not a career, at least never got caught, criminal. But the biggest problem he's going to have, people don't realize, the biggest problem this guy's going to have is he's still got to pay back over $800,000 in restitution. And what the judge did, which was really good for the city of Detroit, if they ever want to get paid, he made a condition of parole. And that means he can't get off parole unless he's paying back the money. And it'll be made into a civil judgment against Kwame if he gets on parole and when he gets on parole. And even if he violates, it'll be a civil judgment that'll follow him around for the rest of his life to the city of Detroit. That is what is going to be the legacy. Not necessarily the time he does in prison, because that's going to go. Not the friends he makes in prison, because they ain't going to want to talk to him when he gets out. It's going to be the money that he's going to always owe the city of Detroit, and they can enforce it. But I can tell you one right now. If you have any type of question on this, you have to go to our website, which is WeinbergOnTheLaw.com. We got a blog that you can read there that goes through everything about this. But if you want to give us your opinion about it, you also can call here at 248-851-1270 here on 1270 WXYT. But I can tell you the main thing that we want to be able to make sure that happens with Kwame is to make sure that when he comes out on parole, that it's still money that is going to be collected. You know what is going to happen? He's going to come out. His mom's going to get him an angel who's going to give him a job again, and they're going to make it so that they can have a now regular restitution, because now it's not a hearing anymore in front of this judge. Now it's going to be a hearing in front of the parole board, and I promise you, they're going to do that and violate him and put it right back in. So we're going to take some more of your questions today. Right now, we're going to hopefully be able to get this congressman on the line, but I want one of the things that we need to do is we need to find out how we can protect your rights. So one of the main things that happens when we go to a break, I want you to go and I want you to go to the website, WeinbergOnTheLaw.com. And I want to answer some of your questions. We had some questions this morning about what happens with the Second Amendment rights. We're going to get to that later on in the show. This is 1270 WXYT.
Have you or a loved one been arrested or charged with a crime? Do you want to stay out of jail and try to keep your record clean? Then you need the attorneys from Weinberg Law at 1-800-7100-LAW. And if you call right now, they can qualify you for a payment plan designed just for you. That's right, an affordable top criminal law firm. Call 1-800-7100-LAW. Stay out of jail, keep your record clean, and qualify for payment plans. Call now, 1-800-710-0529. That's 1-800-7100-LAW. You're listening to Weinberg on the Law on AM 1270 WXYT. Here's your host, Scott Weinberg.
Jobs, jobs, jobs. That is what Michigan is desperate for. Can we turn to a sitting U.S. congressman to grab the wheel of Lansing and drive our state to a successful next 4 years? Well, we're about to find out. I'm joined here today by U.S. Congressman Peter Hoekstra from Holland, Michigan, a graduate of University of Michigan, Go Blue, with a master's in business administration and a successful businessman in his own right. Congressman Hoekstra worked up through the ranks of a great Michigan-based furniture company, we all love, Herman Miller, and became vice president of marketing before leaping in to the national scene, successfully running against a 26-year incumbent for the U.S. House of Representatives in 1992, and now is one of our senior voices in Congress. Congressman, welcome to the Scott Weinberg on the Law Show.
Hey, it's very good to be with you. Thank you. That's a very kind introduction.
Well, we try to help you out in terms of trying to get you representing here in Michigan. I tell you, trying to help everybody that can help this great state. Congressman, I don't know what's going on in the Beltway, but here in Michigan, there is only one issue that is dominant in people's mind, and that is jobs. What is going to save the state of Michigan? Because everyone I talk to is, quite frankly, scared and pessimistic about what's going on in Lansing.
Well, I'll tell you a couple of things. You know, it kind of hit me the other day when I was in Detroit and people started talking about what was happening to Kwame, that he just got sentenced to 5 years. And then it kind of, you know, you kind of look at it and say, wow, you know, really probably the second most powerful political figure in Michigan over the last number of years, the mayor of Detroit, gets indicted for corruption. At the same time, you have a governor in Lansing that has said, you know, not working in the legislature and understanding how a legislature works has really made it difficult for me to get things done. And not coming from a business background, you're taking a look at the top two elected political jobs in the state of Michigan, and you've got one where there was outright corruption. You've got another that really didn't understand the parameters or how to be effective in the job. There's really no surprise that Michigan's in the condition that it is. The number one thing we need is we need leadership that understands business, that understands politics, and that knows how to get things done in both worlds. Then we can start focusing like a laser on creating an environment where people are going to want to invest capital, they're going to want to take risk, and they're going to want to create jobs in Michigan.
Well, that's really one of the things that, you know, and I have kids here too, but we recently interviewed Sheriff Bouchard and State Senator George, obviously, people both you know very well, and about the issues of jobs and how can we expect, quite frankly, our kids to stay in the state when there might not be jobs here. I mean, they want to go to Chicago, they want to go to Boston, but we want to keep them here. What can you do as our next governor to keep them here?
Well, number one, a lot of our kids want to stay. They love Michigan. They grew up here. Second thing is, you know, that's what I'm talking about, creating an environment where you will attract capital into this state, where people will want to invest and grow jobs. Get rid of the bureaucracy. I can't tell you the number of people in Michigan around the state who have wanted, who I've worked with and who I've met with, who have dreams and aspirations about creating jobs, creating wealth right here in Michigan. And then they run into the state bureaucracy. And time again, the state bureaucrats have thrown up barriers to them investing and creating jobs in this state. You put that along with a government in this state that continues to be too expensive and more expensive than what this state can afford. And then thirdly, you put in place a tax code that penalizes investment, that makes it difficult for tourism, and that then, on top of all of that, throws on top a Michigan business tax that is complicated and expensive, along with lousy leadership. And it's like, okay, this is a formula for success. This is a formula for failure. What do you need to do? Great leadership, get bureaucracy out of the way, downsize government, and get rid of a horrendous tax code and replace it with a simple, transparent, and lower tax burden on businesses, and we will all be amazed by what the people of Michigan can do in that kind of environment. They will create jobs, and we will be able to retain our young people, our kids, right here in our state.
What do you think is the next? I mean, speaking of trying to create incentives also for people to come in, what's the next industry you think that we can attract here? I know that they've talked about, obviously, and they've done some good work with the film industry, but is there any other technology firm, company or industry that we can bring here that might not obviously substitute, but supplement what's going on with the auto industry?
I'm not that bright, okay? I want to create a great environment for all businesses and industries to be successful in Michigan and then be ready to be, again, to be surprised by which ones will grow. We've got great potential in agriculture. We still have great potential in manufacturing. Detroit, Southeast Michigan should be a transportation hub. We do need to build a new bridge. We need to build a rail tunnel. We need to build an intermodal transportation system to all go along with our airport, and we will be a transportation hub. We have tremendous opportunities in defense, but government shouldn't pick the winners and the losers. Government shouldn't bless one industry as being more, having more potential than another. Create an environment. Use incentives very, very sparingly when you've got this, you know, a great opportunity. But what we've done in this state, you know, what we've said that if you want to grow in Michigan, you really have to get blessed by the MEDC, the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. And if they think that you're good, they'll give you some incentives and sweetheart deals to get out from under the burden of a very ugly tax code. But, you know, that's not the way it should be. We should have a very good tax code, one that encourages capital investment and capital growth and tells people, hey, you come into Michigan, we're going to allow you to get a fair return on the money that you invest. And then, you know, we'll see what industries grow. That's the exciting thing. My vision is not government picking two or three industries and, you know, getting your, you know, one industry and getting four companies to come in and each create 1,000 jobs and say, wow, look at we spent $200 million of incentives and we got 4,000 jobs. Wouldn't it be exciting if Michigan's 200,000 small businesses, if we created an environment where they didn't have to come to government to get their blessing, they felt economic freedom, they were willing to take the risk, they invested, and 50,000 small companies in Michigan all added one job.
We're talking with U.S. Congressman Peter Hoekstra from Holland, Michigan, this morning here on CBS Radio, WXYT Detroit. Now, Congressman, I know you've been in Washington. You've been a good voice for us. But, you know, quite frankly, you are the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, the minority member. And if you become governor, won't we lose a strong voice in Washington? Don't we need that kind of voice there?
Sure. We need strong voices in Washington representing Michigan. I'm sure that there's more qualified people in the there are qualified people in the 2nd District of Michigan who can come to Washington and do a great job. There are other great voices for Michigan in Washington today. You know, Mike Rogers, Thaddeus McCotter, Candace Miller. You know, we've got a lot of good people representing Michigan in Washington. We can't all stay here forever. You know, we can't all be a John Dingell. We're not all going to stay here for 54, 56 years. There's a natural ebb and flow. I've had a great opportunity to serve the people of Michigan and Washington. I've never left Michigan. When I'm in Washington, I sleep on my couch. I don't have a place to live here other than my office. When I get done with work at night, I pull out the sleeping bag, throw on the pillow on the couch, and that's where I sleep. My wife and I thought it was a good time for us to take a look at other opportunities. As we talked to people, they really thought with my kind of background, trying to be the next governor of Michigan to help lead this state and give economic freedom to people across the state was the kind of thing that we could get very, very excited about.
I wanted to ask you about one thing. As long as you mentioned, obviously, of the amount of time that influence that has been going on with you in Washington, I know you've been obviously a congressman with that kind of influence that has helped us out. But, you know, the thing I'm always worried about is what is the situation when a congressman comes here to Michigan and you have that kind of influence in Washington? Can you, if you are our governor, can we help bring the jobs here to Michigan? Can that influence, for instance, bringing other industries here to Michigan because you had that kind of influence in Congress?
Well, I mean, one of the things that a lot of people in Southeast Michigan are talking with me about are saying, you know, we have an opportunity and we've got the skills that would enable us to be good defense contractors, to be good in the aerospace industry.
Right, we should bring that. That's a great idea.
Yeah, and you know, the nice thing about that is I've got a lot of relationships in the defense industry with these companies. I know who to call. I know who to approach and say, hey, you know, as you're building, we just did this with Boeing a couple of weeks ago. Boeing was in Lansing. They were presenting to Michigan suppliers, Michigan manufacturers, the opportunities of that might be available to them if Congress decided to go ahead and purchase new refueling aircraft from Boeing Corporation. It's kind of like, you know, the number that they threw out that said this is going to mean this many jobs for Michigan. And my response was, I know Boeing. I know this company. You know, they build lots of stuff for the Intel community. We know the people there. We're not going to be satisfied with 400 jobs. We're not going to be satisfied with 1,000 jobs. We're going to show you what the manufacturers and the people of Michigan can do so that hopefully we can go out and we can create the opportunities for 4,000, 5,000, 10,000 aerospace jobs in here in Michigan because we're better than anybody else, and we're going to use my connections in Washington, not to get a sweetheart deal, but to make sure that people at Boeing and other defense contractors know the capabilities of Michigan manufacturers and Michigan workers that no longer may be working for the automotive industry, but we still have the skills in the state.
Well, that is something we definitely need, that's for sure, here in the state. I know that you've been dealing with America's Speaking Out initiative by the House Republicans. Tell us about that. How would that give Michigan a greater voice in Washington?
Well, what America's Speaking Out says, hey, you know, check our websites out and tell us what you want America's agenda to be here in Washington. It's the same kind of approach that we're going to be taking in the state. We're going to have a great time over the last 8-9 weeks of this campaign, continuing to talk with the people in Michigan about the ideas that they have and the agenda that they want us to embark on in Lansing. And like I said, I've got a lot of those ideas already from them because they've told me what are the barriers to economic growth in Michigan from you as a small business person. They say, Pete, get bureaucracy out of the way, get rid of this ridiculous tax code, and we will do just fine. You know, most people in Michigan, they're not looking for more help from government. They figured out that help from government sometimes gets to be too expensive, too burdensome, and really is no help at all. They just want, I find a lot of people in Michigan who are just asking for, give me a little bit more freedom. I don't need any more mandates. Give me some freedom, and I'll be just fine.
Give me a job that I can prove myself at, too.
Yep, absolutely. Yep.
We've been talking to U.S. Congressman Peter Hoekstra from the beautiful Holland, Michigan. Congressman, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today, and I hope that we can have you back on the show. You've answered questions, quite frankly, candidly, and hope to see you in the future.
Hey, absolutely. Look forward to it. Thank you very much.
Take care. How are we going to do that? How are we going to bring back jobs to this state? I mean, that is exactly what we need to do. One of the things that the congressman was saying that, quite frankly, I felt was the most interesting is that because of his influence in Congress, he's got the relationships to potentially go to other states and get companies to come here because that's what we need. We need manufacturing jobs. We need the ability to employ our citizenry. You know, as a criminal lawyer, I see so much more substance abuse, so much more just depression in people that they just fall into disrepair. Their lives are in disrepair. They're going bankrupt. They obviously lost their jobs. Their unemployment ends. And if we could bring back, I'm telling you, the number one thing, okay, this is what I say. The number one thing that can reduce crime in this state is give people jobs. When you have a job, when you got to go somewhere every day, you have so much responsibility, you don't have time to be doing the things that you can do now in your leisurely life because you don't have a job. Drinking, doing all the different things that, quite frankly, lead to other types of problems with your families and with crime. It is definitely a situation where we do not have a citizenry that's employed enough, that's busy enough, that's being productive enough to come and, like anything else, stay out of our court system. We need to make sure that we can bring someone to Lansing, whether it's a congressman, whoever it is, that we can make sure that they can have the influence to bring in people these types of industries, this manufacturing sector. So, you know, as a criminal lawyer, I can focus directly and laserly right on where it affects the individual and staying off the streets, that they're not using any type of substances that's going to affect them on a daily basis because they're just too busy. Well, I tell you something, in talking about going and protecting our streets, that is exactly what we need to do. We need to turn to a situation where are our laws protecting our kids and our laws protecting everybody else, and even, quite frankly, even their parents. Is it legal to let your 18-year-old son, who is a senior in high school, to have sex with his 15-year-old sophomore girlfriend? Well, everyone does it, you might say. What are we to do? But quite frankly, it could land him in prison and on the sex offendery list for 25 years. Well, you betcha. That's one of the things that we're going to be talking about this morning. What are the laws regarding our kids having sex, and how it was the largest prosecutor's office in the state of Michigan deciding to prosecute these cases? Well, today we have a chance to ask one of these prosecutors. Laura Weingarten is an assistant prosecuting attorney for Wayne County, Kim Worsey's office, who we've had on the show several times. She's in charge of the child abuse unit since being there and appointed there in 2004. She's been a prosecutor since 1985 for over 25 years, a graduate of University of Michigan, Go Blue, and Wayne State University Law School. Laura, welcome to the Weinberg on the Law Show.
Thanks, Scott.
Laura, you know, one of the things that we talk about here, and I know that you obviously deal with it because you talk to kids in schools, is what are the laws regarding our age of consent? Because that is something, while people talk about the term statutory rape, I don't think people really realize how they could get in trouble having any kind of sexual contact under the age of 16.
Okay, you're right, Scott. Our education system does not teach our kids what the laws are relating to sex. In Michigan, the age of consent is 16, and that's for both boys and for girls. That means that if you are not 16, you cannot engage in any kind of sex, not sexual contact, certainly not sexual intercourse, and not oral sex. And our kids are not being taught that. And therefore, usually it's an older boy with a younger girl, and they don't realize that the older boy is going to get into big trouble when he has sexual relations with his younger girlfriend.
But every prosecutor is different. And, you know, Laura and I have worked together for years in different cases. And as a criminal defense attorney, you see all around the state, quite frankly, all around the country, because I'm also an attorney in Chicago, but all around this state, every prosecutor's office has a different policy of when to bring these charges. There's no uniformity in terms of, let's say that there's 2 years difference or 3 years difference. How can we as parents, I mean, how can we know what to advise our kids when we don't know what our county prosecutor is going to do?
I'm a parent also of two teenage boys, and my advice to every parent is to tell their girls and their boys that if someone is not 16, they should not be having sex or sexual contact. It's a bright line. The law says 16. Now, as a practical matter, as you said...
Really? I mean, does that really work? I mean, come on.
Well, I hope it's worked so far in my family.
I hope so, too.
But we do. There are things that we do when we do have a youthful offender, and by youthful I mean a child who's 17, 18, 19, or 20, who is having... and I'm putting this in quotations, consensual sex with a younger partner. As long as that partner is 13 and up, so not 12 or under, but 13 and up, if it's consensual, meaning the older person didn't force the younger person, we have a special program that we can put them on called HYTA. It's H-Y-T-A, and it stands for Holmes Youthful Trainee Act. It's a provision that our legislature wrote that allows these youthful offenders to be put on probation, and if they complete probation without any other violations of the law, Their name does not go on the sex offender registry, and they don't have a criminal conviction at the end of it.
And that's so important to try to keep these kids, especially that can be in that program, off the sex offender list. Because quite frankly, no matter what happens, that is one of the lasting effects of these criminal sexual conduct convictions.
Yes, being on the registry is maybe worse than having a conviction, because what happens is if you apply to go to college or you apply for a job, the public has easy access to the sex offender registry. We could go on it right now and find out who amongst our neighbors are on the list or in our zip code, and certainly colleges and employers can do that also. No college or employer wants a sex offender on their campus or in their workplace.
What do you think about that? Do you think that there are crimes that now you are being convicted of criminal sexual conduct? Obviously, there's horrific ones, too. And, you know, there's just like this one in out west where there's people that are committing violent rapes. But there's also ones that are much more, I don't want to say common, they're much more, I guess, less aggressive. They're ones that they fall under the registry. They're criminal sexual conduct, fourth degree, a high misdemeanor, but they still have to register. Do you think it's fair that their neighbors are able to see that they are convicted of it?
Well, the goal of the registry is to give the public notice so that adults can protect their children if they bother to look on the registry. There are probably some people on the registry who are not dangerous and who the public doesn't need to know about. There's a common misconception. Those who argue that the sex offender registry is too broad, they say that if you get caught urinating in public, you go on the registry. And that's just not true.
Right.
That crime is called indecent exposure. You have to be convicted of that crime three times before you have to register as a sex offender.
Right. There's a lot of misconceptions, that is for sure, that every type of what people would say are public indecencies, even things that, for instance, to say that you're pleasuring yourself in public. I mean, should those things be on the registry?
Well, that would be called aggravated indecent exposure, and you have to get convicted twice of that before you go on the registry.
And that makes sense. I mean, those are people that, quite frankly, either bad judgment or make a mistake. They really should be given another chance to not be on that. But if they do it again, you know, maybe it is appropriate that they're on there.
Yes. I think most of the time, the people who are on the registry belong there.
What about teachers? I mean, tell us about that. How have you prosecuted teachers that have committed these sex offenses, and are they separately listed, or are they just sort of combined with all the different people that are convicted and now on this registry?
Okay, we have had teachers and coaches convicted of sex crimes. Usually the scenario is that they have, quote, an affair with an underage student. And interestingly, we have more female teachers doing that with boy students than we do adult male teachers with girl students
in
recent years.
And is that something your office has prosecuted, these women having sex with the kid?
Absolutely.
With the
boys? We take it very, very seriously. When a parent sends a kid to school, the last thing on their mind is, I have to protect my child from his teachers or her teachers. So we take it very seriously. There are women that we've prosecuted that are in prison as we speak for having relationships with the students. And there are pending cases also, which I can't talk about because they're pending.
What is the, and I know that you had talked about something before regarding the HIDTA, but what is the Romeo and Juliet cases?
Okay, by Romeo and Juliet cases, we're referring to teenage affairs, teenage romantic relationships. And as I said, it's usually an older boy with a younger girl, although not necessarily. We've had older girls with younger boys.
Is that something that you prosecute? You know, when I was a prosecutor, I don't think I ever saw that, an older girl having sex with, other than a teacher, like you were talking about. I guess, you know what, we've had it where there were mothers of kids, and that was actually more common than I thought, that the mothers of the kids were having sex with their young boy, teenage boy's friends.
Yes, we've had those too.
I mean, that was amazing. I think I saw like three or four of those cases in the couple of years I was there. And you know what? That actually, in one way, you know, you sit there and you look at, you know, Summer 42, or you look at movies that depict it as being romantic and it being a situation where it really can be a young boy's dream. But psychologically, it has a lot of effect on these boys when they're having those kind of relationships with older women.
Yes, it's it's a misconception that if a boy is having a relationship with an older woman, you know, good for him, attaboy, and we pat him on the back. I think that's an old school thought process. They are young, they're developing in terms of their sexuality and their maturity, and the last thing they should be thinking about is having sex with their teacher or with their friend's mother. I mean, they need to be growing and maturing in a normal way and not being taught by this older woman. And it is damaging to them, even though at the moment they may not think so. But I've talked with men who have had relationships with older women when they were teenagers, and as they grow up and mature, they realize how detrimental it was to them. So we know we're doing the right thing by prosecuting these adults or older people having sex with younger people.
Now, I know that you were talking with Lauren Weingarten, assistant prosecutor in Wayne County Prosecutor's Office. I know that you talk in schools, too. But do you feel that the schools are giving any type of sex ed that's working?
Whatever they're giving is not working. I interview kids often, and the first thing that strikes me is that they're never using birth control. And it's bad enough they're doing it, but they're not using birth control. And we have so many kids who are pregnant or who get diseases. Who knows? We wouldn't know if they're exposed to HIV because those test results come down later down the road. But whatever the schools are doing, it's not adequate.
But do you think we should be handing out condoms in schools? Because I know they do that around the country.
You know, I don't know that it's the school's place to do it, but maybe the health department should be the one doing it. Or the parents. If the parents know their kids are having sex and they're not going to abstain, it's the parents' responsibility to make sure that children are educated about how to avoid pregnancy and disease.
I mean, that is really the main thing. You know, they've had it, and Lori, we're about the same age, all through our lives, where how do you talk to kids? How did our parents talk to us if they did it at all? And how do you talk to our kids, whether they're young kids or even teenage kids now, about sex? Because there's no teenage kid that doesn't know about sex. That's not the issue, is do they know about it? It's what you were talking about that makes sense, which is how do they know, one, what the law is of consent, and two, how do they protect themselves from any type of pregnancy disease? And that really is, I don't care what people say about health education, that is the important thing to learn, not just from the school, but from your parents.
Right. And the parents have to start young. They have to start when the child is 2 years old and in the bathtub and teach them the proper names for body parts and teach them who's allowed to touch you there. And by the time the child is old enough to wipe themselves after using the bathroom and to bathe themselves, the child should be told only you, yourself, and your doctor can touch you there. And as they're growing up, I would explain to them that the law in Michigan is that if you're not 16, you can't let anyone touch you and you can't touch anyone else. And if you do, you're going to have a criminal record. And I would talk about what are the effects of a criminal record. Well, you might not get into college. You might not be employable, et cetera. And that you talk about the fact that you could go to prison for up to 15 years. And it's pretty much a scared straight with facts that are legitimate and real. We're not lying to these kids. We're telling them like it is.
Well, that is scary. That is true, because I really do believe that most people, especially parents, don't realize how young that age of consent is. We've been joined here by Laura Weingarten, the assistant prosecutor in the Child Abuse Unit at Wayne County, Kim Worthy's office. Laura, it's been educational. I appreciate it. Hopefully we'll be able to get you back on and talk about some of the other good things that you're doing, but protecting our children and also doing some fair prosecutions. Hopefully we'll be able to get you back on this summer. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me. Goodbye.
One of the main things that she was talking about is clearly when we educate our kids in good touches, bad touches, and that education, even under the age of 10, is so important. So we'll follow up on that criminal sexual conduct discussion and learning all our rights here on 1270 WXYT.
You're listening to Weinberg on the Law on AM 1270 WXYT. Here's your host, Scott Weinberg.
Welcome back to the show. We were just talking with Assistant Prosecutor Laura Weingarten in the Criminal Sexual Conduct Unit. You know, the things she was talking about, I mean, they're so important for us to know. I get asked this question all the time because I used to be a criminal sexual conduct prosecutor, and I've also represented people for almost 20 years that have been charged with these crimes. And I get asked that question all the time. How old can my kid be in order to have any kind of sexual contact? And unfortunately for our teens, it's under the age of 16. And what Laura was talking about, which quite frankly, it is really true. These prosecutors' office are prosecuting kids that are just like that, 18 years old, having sex with like a 14-year-old. And whether you think it's right or not, you could have a freshman in high school with a senior boyfriend, and they could prosecute him. Now, it happens many different ways, too. I mean, obviously, it happens a 25-year-old having sex with a 13-year-old. I mean, so there's so many inappropriate decisions that older guys make, even older meaning over 18, with teenage kids. But the one thing that we need to know is mistake of age is not a defense. So even if this kid, whether it's a boy or girl, under the age of 16, lies and says, no, I'm 16 and has some type of sexual contact, it is not a defense, and they still prosecute that offender. So it doesn't have to be like in Nevada, we had this man convicted of rape and strangling a college student. It's not just the way they prosecute. Most cases are not like that. Most cases are situations where it's a boyfriend, girlfriend, or if it's a someone that they meet in a bar, they go to a party, and it is a, I'm talking about statutory rape. It's a question of, are they under the law able to give consent? That is what they're talking about in terms of statutory rape, not these otherwise violent crimes. So we really have to educate our kids to know that, hey, you want to take that chance, it could be on your record for the rest of your life. I want to get to some of the other news that we were talking about earlier today, and this just sad case in Macomb County in court where the drunk driver and the family speak out, where this drunk driver, Francis Dingell, was sentenced to 22 and a half years to 25 years in prison for second-degree murder charges in a hearing that, quite frankly, brought everybody, including the judge, to tears. And without going through all the names of the victims in this case, it's so sad when you have anybody die, but definitely when you have these four teens die, that happened last fall with an impact, or last spring with an impact of a car at a Macomb mall, and all these kids got killed. You know, I've represented people that have been involved in their first drunk driving before that someone was killed. And the main thing there are these people charged with OWI, operating while intoxicated, causing death, which is a 15-year felony, or are they going to be charged with second-degree murder? And that is the difference on how much time they're going to get. In the situation regarding this Macomb woman, Dingell, 48, pled no contest to four counts of murder, as well as four counts of drunk driving causing the death, and she received all that time. You know, even though her blood alcohol level was double the legal limit, when you lose a child, it doesn't matter how high, as long as it's at or over the legal limit of the defendant, you're devastated. Your life is destroyed. And, you know, that's one of the things that any defendant can't come up with any statement. I've represented thousands of defendants that at sentencing tried to explain what's going on with what they were thinking and how sorry they are. And it never makes a difference, quite frankly, with the victims. This defendant said, I've searched the depths of my soul, but there's no way I can express how sorry I am. And she couldn't finish even reading her own statement. So when you have these kind of tragic situations, all you can do is you can just thank God that when you have a drunk driving, all you can do as a defendant, if you've ever been charged with drunk driving, is you sit there and say, that's all I'm charged with. I didn't kill anybody. And not even just myself. I didn't kill anybody that wasn't in my car. And sometimes that is about the only solace you can come up with that makes it seem like, well, at least I can defend myself in the drunk driving, but no matter what happens on it, I did not take anybody else's life. Because it doesn't matter if you've had one drunk, this is your first drunk driving, or your fifth, a death occurs in either situation on the issue, on the car moving and getting into a crash. The car doesn't care if it's your second or third violation. In other news, a teacher caught in this lewd act at the party out in a little while ago out in St. Clair County. Did you read about this? That they had a Michigan public school teacher that they discovered can't be fired for private behavior that happens outside the school. Basically, the teacher was making some type of lewd, and they would say lascivious, conduct by doing some type of pretend sex act, but she wasn't in the school. She wasn't doing it for the kids, but someone took a movie of it, someone took a picture, they posted it on YouTube, and all of a sudden now they fired her. But you know what happened? They appealed the decision and basically said, no, we're not going to get rid of her. We're going to keep her because she didn't do anything that she knew was going to be used and online, that she depicted herself and submitted to be able to be used. And that's the question. We're going to talk about that next time on the show next week. Should we hold teachers the same kind of their conduct to the same standard that we would hold public officials? Because we hold public officials, no question about it, to a higher standard. Hey, whether it's Kwame Kilpatrick sitting up there in Jackson in quarantine right now, whether it's President Clinton lying years ago in Washington, or whether it's Elliot Spitzer in New York, we hold our public officials to a higher standard. Should we do that with our teachers? We'll talk about that next week. And we're also going to talk about our Second Amendment rights. Who is it that the government can take our rights away to own guns? Should we be able to own any kind of weapon under the Second Amendment? So we're going to go through that with our Bill of Rights, and we're going to say, is President Obama curtailing our rights to have CCWs, and should we start going out there and trying to apply it? If you want to go online this week and talk to us about it, go on WeinbergOnTheLaw.com. We've got all the different interviews. You can listen to everything again and also blog and give us your comments on it. We'll be protecting your rights every week here on Weinberg on the Law. And this is Scott Weinberg. Come back and join us next week.
You've been listening to Weinberg on the Law on CBS Radio, WXYT Detroit, AM 1270.